Hello, everyone, and welcome to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. Part of what drives my coaching career, and by extension this podcast, is to provide hope, knowledge, and assurance that we can all be more fulfilled and successful if we choose. I believe that there is tremendous power in choice. We are confronted with choices from the time we wake up in the morning until the time our heads hit the pillow at the end of the day. Will I choose to believe in possibilities for myself? Or will I choose to believe in my limitations? Will I choose courage? Or will I choose fear? Will I choose to listen to those who believe in me? Or will I choose to listen to those who doubt me and tell me that I'm not good enough? Will I choose to do the work that I know that I need to do in order to move towards my desired future? And will I choose that consistently, every day, not just once or not just for a couple of weeks, but every day for the long haul? I spent about 10 years of my life recovering from an illness that one doctor said I only had a 3% chance of recovering. And here's what I learned. I had to choose possibilities. Even when I wasn't even fully sure of what those could be, I had to choose courage. I had to choose to listen to those who believed that I would recover. And I had to do the tedious, grinding work that, at the beginning, seemed so bleak and so far away from any sort of desirable future. But I knew one truth. If I did nothing, nothing would change. And at least I was going to give myself a chance at a desirable future. This podcast was created to help you make the choices that will propel you towards your desired future. So what are we waiting for? Let's get to this week's episode. My guest today made a choice way back in 2012 that would cost him everything. After exploiting the warranty policy of one of the largest tech companies in the world for almost a year, the FBI finally knocked on his door. He was arrested and sentenced to 2 years of federal prison, followed by 3 years of supervised release and ordered to pay over $800,000 in restitution. He lost his wife, his homes, his cars, his career, and even his identity. He wanted nothing more than to die. A well-timed prison visit from his best friend of over 30 years turned his life around. Today, he's a reinvention architect and mindset coach. He is a best-selling author, TEDx, and keynote speaker. He works one-on-one with clients so they can re-architect their lives with joy, meaning, purpose, and fulfillment. His name is Craig Stanlin, and I think that you'll enjoy meeting him. Craig, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Bobby, thank you so much for having me. We were chatting a little bit before we started recording, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun.
I think so too. And it's, again, one of those times when I think I should just record from the very beginning, because sometimes, you know, good stuff comes up beforehand, and I'm like, rats, we missed it. That's okay. It'll come up again.
I think we were priming the pump, and I think we're just it's all going to come flowing through naturally.
I think so too. So why don't you get us started and share a little bit about who you are and your story?
Absolutely. So my name is Craig Stanlin. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I am a reinvention architect, a TEDx and keynote speaker, and a best-selling author. How I found myself to do all of these things is, I think, where the interesting story comes in. So I'll rewind a little bit to September 30th, 2013. I had what most people would say was it all. I owned multiple homes. I drove the nice cars. I wore five-figure watches. I was a VIP at the finest restaurants in Manhattan and Greenwich, Connecticut. I was married to an amazing woman. I had a really incredible career working for a technology company, selling all of their products into the largest financial institutions in the world. It looked brilliant from the outside on September 30th, 2013. On October 1st, 2013, I had just walked in to my brand new job. Our biggest competitor wooed me away with a very very lucrative pay package. I had just arrived at my desk. I was bringing all my stuff out, my laptop, my notebook, my phone. And I looked at my phone and I noticed there was a missed call and a voicemail, which I thought was so strange because I had the phone on me the entire time. And I put it to my ear and I listened to the voicemail and it was the following. "Mr. Stanlin, this is Special Agent McTiernan with the FBI. We are at your residence and have a warrant for your arrest. You need to call us and come home immediately, or we will issue a warrant with the federal marshals."
Wow.
That is the day that I lost it all.
Yeah.
Just under a year, I committed fraud against one of the largest technology companies in the world. And October 1st, I was arrested by the FBI. I subsequently pled guilty to one count of mail fraud, because I was guilty. I was sentenced to 2 years of federal prison, 3 years of supervised release, and ordered to pay restitution in excess of $800,000.
Wow.
And it just literally was the day that my life changed.
Yeah. Oh my God. When you said that about when you started repeating the message, like I got chills. Like I can't even imagine what it felt like to get that call.
It was. So something extreme. Two very interesting things happened. Number one, all of the oxygen in the room vanished. I had difficulty breathing. My heart and stomach fell the 37 floors I had just gone up. And number two, when I started committing the fraud, I knew what I was doing was wrong. And my heart spoke. And before I hit the send button, because everything was done through my laptop, it was all a series of mouse clicks and hitting the enter button, hitting the send button. Before I hit that send button to initiate, my heart said, "Stop, don't do this. This is not the way." And after I heard that voicemail, my heart spoke again and said, "I told you so."
Oh, yeah. That's painful.
It was so crushing. And a very strange thing, I think, was I had the phone up to my ear. However, I thought that that voicemail was broadcast via a PA system, essentially to the world, but especially to all of my new colleagues, half of whom I didn't even know their name at that time. I was so fresh and so new. And I literally thought there was this neon sign over my head saying "wanted by the FBI."
Yeah. You know what? I can totally understand that. Totally understand it. You know, Craig, I remember reading one of your LinkedIn posts and you talked about that moment before hitting send and like, you know, your heart, whatever, saying, "Don't do it, don't do it." What do you think led to it?
It's a cocktail of so many different things. And what I've come to realize is that I subconsciously blew up my life because I was so far from the life that I truly wanted to be living.
Wow.
And it took a long time to come to that point. And it's going to be a little bit part of my second book is going to be the analysis of that massive self-sabotage and what that looks like. And to unpack that a little bit further, there was just this combination of events that had occurred. The products that I was selling were becoming more commoditized. So the margins were shrinking. And so my paychecks were shrinking. I was so caught up in the lifestyle of the nice car, as the nice watches, of going out for those fancy lunches and those fancy dinners, I wasn't working as hard. I was hanging out with my wife at the time. I was hanging out with her all the time. I wasn't working the way that I should have been working. So that impacted my paychecks. My identity, who I am as a human being, was so interwoven with all of those things, with all of that materialism, that who I was being threatened. And I needed to fix that. Coupled with the fact that I always wanted to start my own business. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to write. I wanted to write a screenplay. I wanted to just create and be innovative. And when I realized the mechanism of my fraud, I looked at it as an outlet for that entrepreneurial desire. So all of these things came together in this really potent cocktail that led me to move through that heart saying, "Stop, don't do this. This is not the way."
Yeah, this isn't you.
This isn't me.
Yeah. So there's so much there I want to explore. So, you know, the part of you that wanted to be creative, be the entrepreneur, write, you know, the screenplay, was that a part of you that you had like set aside in order to be successful?
Yes. That is, I love the way that you just unpack that. It was as if I couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time. Yeah. It's a silly way of saying it, but it really is.
But it's like, true.
I'm putting all, 100% into the corporate life. And there's no room for me to experiment with writing or creating or taking, you know, the million different ideas that were floating around in my mind and bringing them to fruition. It was very black and white thinking, all or nothing.
The all or nothing. And, you know, what's interesting about that is in, you know, less dramatic ways, I think a lot of people fall into that. Well, I, you know, because I'm doing X and I put all of my effort into being successful at work or, you know, to providing for my family, whatever that is, we put so much into one role that we can neglect the others until often there's a crisis that wakes us up and says, you got to make a change.
I refer to it as the golden treadmill.
Yes.
We're just running on this golden treadmill and we can choose. I see three options with this. We can stay on the treadmill and just run furiously trying to catch the horizon, which we're never going to do.
Never.
Until, unfortunately, we breathe our last breath. And it's one of regret. Number two, life knocks us off the treadmill. Mine was the prison sentence.
Yep.
Number three, I actually think is the hardest. And that is a conscious, deliberate choice to slow the treadmill down and to fully stop it and to get off.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that is why I think it's the hardest. Why do you think that one is the hardest?
Because they're one of my fears. And I see this in my clients and I see this with friends. Is I feel like it's akin to what you were just saying or what we were talking about of putting all the eggs in one basket. The idea that you have to burn everything to the ground to start over.
Yeah.
That is such a false limiting belief, but it's so huge. I am so invested in being a C-level executive, in doing whatever my job is, that I can't unwind that identity. So to really have that conscious awareness to say, I'm not living the life that I want to live, and I want to take a risk and do something else, that's one of the hardest decisions that we can ever make.
Yeah, because you've worked, a person works hard for that success, you know?
So hard, 20 years, 30 years, however long it may be, that's a huge investment of time and an identity.
Yeah, but to your point, you don't have to burn everything to the ground in order to make...
Yeah, you absolutely don't have to. And I think it is something so critical for people to remember, you know, we can dial back our jobs from 100% to 95%. And if we take, I think shifting the paradigm even more leads to a more meaningful and fulfilling life, but at a bare minimum, turning it down, let's say to 95%, taking that extra 5% and scheduling time to do things that you enjoy, to do things that you love, to branch out and explore that part of you that's calling for more, that you don't quite know what it is. And, you know, all of the materialism hasn't been filling that gap that you feel.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it might be creative. It might be wanting to teach. It might be wanting to give back, whatever it may be, but just giving yourself that permission to go down that road a little bit.
Yeah. And I think with that too is when you're so busy, you almost can't do that because you don't have the bandwidth to do it. You need the space and the margin in order to be able to do it.
Absolutely. And I would gently push back on that a little bit. We get so caught up in thinking that we're so busy. What
That's
is
right.
actually busy work and what is productive work? What can be outsourced? Oftentimes, and I was very guilty of this, was measuring my self-worth by how much I got done in a day.
Yep.
Each day was a scorecard. And so to be busy from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. it was a huge, you know, win for me. You know, I won
That's
the
right.
day. But if I were to look back, so much of that was busy work. So much of that could have been delegated. So much of that didn't even need to be done. Didn't even need to be on the to-do list.
Yeah. And how much of it sometimes is just about feeding our own ego? Look how important I am. You know what I mean?
That's such a brilliant point. Absolutely. When the ego's driving the bus, we're really never going to get off that treadmill.
No, we're in trouble.
We're in huge trouble.
You know, and right there, Craig, you mentioned about self-worth. And I remember in your TEDx talk, you talked, and I hope I get this right, but you said something like, you know, before that your self-worth was tied to your, like, your ability to buy things, to acquire things. And then you had a shift while you were in prison. And can you speak to that a little bit?
Huge shift. And yeah, I was. My self-worth was not only wrapped into the things themselves, but my just pure ability to be able to walk into my, I had a watch guy. And, you know, the fact that I could walk in and, I don't say this to brag, but drop 8,000 on a watch, you know, at any given moment, just knowing that I could do that. That was just so much of my self-worth and who I was tied to that. And now, you know, I'm in prison having lost everything. I got divorced. I lost my career. There was a court order barring me from my industry. No money, no homes, no real future. And I became suicidal.
Yeah.
I became suicidal, and it was just pure shame.
Yeah.
Just that pure shame led me to plan how I was going to kill myself. And I'll go even a little bit deeper on it. My mind had concocted a short film of what my suicide would look like. And it was very graphic and it was very detailed. And at first, I only played that short film sporadically. And I would just wave it off and say, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to see that. But then it started playing it every second of every day for 4 months straight.
I remember you said that in the talk, and I'm like, that would be hell.
It was hell on earth. It was absolutely hell on earth. I would go to sleep at night wishing for the hand of death to kill me. And I would wake up disappointed at the light of a new day. It was just such a level of personal torture.
Yeah.
And I thought I was completely worthless. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't share this story with anybody. Because if you mention suicide in prison, they lock you in solitary confinement. And that really, I was already so, even though I was surrounded by some amazing individuals, I felt already so isolated. And the idea of being locked in solitary scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
So I couldn't mention it on the phone because the calls are recorded. Couldn't email family about it because they read emails. Couldn't mention it to any of my friends in prison out of concern that they would go to a guard or a prison official and say, hey, Craig's not in a good place. So I just bottled it up inside of me. Just bottled it up for all of that time and planning how I could make it stop. How can I make this come to an end? Then it was this random Wednesday. I get an email from my best friend of 30 plus years. His name is Sean. And real, it was one sentence. Hey, man, can I come for a visit this weekend? I said, yes. Yes, you can. Because the visiting room is not monitored. And Sean was my best friend, is my best friend for 30 plus years. I can trust him with this information. So it takes forever for Saturday to come. I mean, it literally feels like it's an eternity. And I see him park his truck, makes the long walk up the hill, goes into the visiting room. We hug each other. We get some food. And I can feel the excitement building inside of me that I get to unload this thing. You know, I was basically like a club soda bottle walking around, just shaking it up without being able to remove the cap. I could just feel that. We sit down and I open my mouth to let it all out. Before I can utter a word, Sean starts to speak. His life is a complete mess. He's getting a divorce. He's got work issues. He's got money issues. And he is just so upset. And there's just this sadness in his eyes and in his voice that in our 30 plus years of friendship, I had never seen nor heard. And it was at that moment I realized that I had worth outside of all the things that I had thought made me worthy. I was a friend, and that was all that I needed to be.
Yeah.
And that was the day. October was first was the day my life changed. Sean's visit was the second day my life changed.
Wow. I remember hearing that in your TEDx talk, and I was like, just moved by it, just like I am now, because in the simplest of ways, not because of doing anything or being like, just because you are, you know, you matter.
There's so much power in that. And I think what speaks volumes to this is that I never shared with Sean at that time how I was feeling. I just listened to him. He got it all out. Then we started talking about what our friends are up to, what's going on in prison. We had a great visit. but I didn't even need to explain it to him because it released it all that much. It wasn't until I wrote the book and that's a chapter in the book. And I wanted to run it by him to make sure that he was okay with that being published, you know, to the world. He had no idea of the impact of that visit. No idea.
See, that was something I wanted to ask you. Like, if you ever told him, if he knew, when he found out, how did he respond?
He read the chapter, and the girl that he was dating at the time, she told me this when he was not around. Sean's a tough guy. I mean, he is just he's a tough, tough man. She said that he had tears in his eyes. He had no idea. Yeah. He had no idea of the impact that he had. And it was really sweet of him. He then forwarded the chapter to his entire family, who I'm also very close with.
Aww.
And they were all just floored as well.
Wow. I'm so glad you got a chance to share that with him. You know, because there are so many times we have those moments and we never know, you know, how we make a difference for someone.
I think that's such an interesting thing is, you know, kindness and, you know, the small acts of kindness, to just do them for the sake of doing them, because we have no idea the ripple effects of our actions.
None.
We, you know, I get some amazing emails from people about my book or about the TED Talk, and I'm floored and I'm honored and I'm humbled, but I can only imagine the people who don't reach out. And it doesn't have to be a book. It doesn't have to be a TED Talk. It can be, and I'm not saying this to be trite, it could be smiling at somebody who looks like they're having a crappy day when you see them walking down the street. You just don't know.
You don't know. You really don't. Like when I was traveling a lot before COVID, I always made a point when I got on the plane, being nice to the flight attendants. Hey, how are you today? Or nice earrings, you know, because I figure these are people who don't get a lot of niceties thrown their way. You know what I mean? I can't imagine that job. I'm like, hey, maybe it'll brighten their day a little bit. Who knows? And it made me feel better. So, you know, wow. Now, so what do you believe now, like about self-worth? What's it based on now?
It's internal. True self-worth is intrinsic. And it's the understanding that we're inherently worthy just by our mere existence.
Yeah.
And I compound that by cultivating meaning in my life. And I think that is something so important. It is to leverage my story to be of service to others, to write. I love writing. And that's really, that is my outlet. That is my calling. And to be able to do that every day really cultivates that sense of meaning. You know, knowing that what I'm trying to put out there, I set a goal, really. It wasn't even a goal necessarily. When I was writing my first book, I started in prison. And it was just the most frustrating process in the world. I'm writing with pen and paper, you know, those old black and white composition notebooks that we used in school.
Yeah.
Which I still use for journaling.
I love them.
They're brilliant. Mine's sitting right next to me as we speak. But I started writing in the prison library. And I was writing about getting divorced. I'm writing about getting arrested by the FBI. These things that had only just occurred. And I didn't know what the heck I was doing. It was an extremely frustrating process. I'm writing about things that hurt, that are painful. And I started thinking, I go, I don't know what I'm doing. Getting a book published is next to impossible. Who's going to read this thing in the first place? I'm in prison. Why am I torturing myself this way? This is asinine and it's ludicrous. And I threw my pen in complete disgust. And my heart, that same heart that told me not to do it, the same heart that said, I told you so, it spoke again. And I flipped to a blank page and I wrote the answer. And it said to help one person.
That's right.
That is why I do what I do now. And that is that meaning and that worth, just connecting with that. That was the fuel that carried me through 6 years of writing that book and still carries me to this day.
Yeah. So, and I love that, because if we help one person, you know, like when I speak or I give presentations or whatever I'm doing, I think if it benefits one person, that's perfect.
It's amazing. And it's so powerful. And I think that if somebody has a calling, well, I'll use Google, for example, really will not, with their special project section, they really won't look at a project that won't impact a billion people. And I think that's wonderful that we have people that are doing things like that. But a calling and a desire to do something, it does not have to be that, you know, just one person is massive unto itself.
Because of the ripple effect.
Because of the ripple effect.
You know, I love that too, because I think sometimes when people think about meaning or purpose, they think, well, it has to affect a billion people or a million people. And it's like, does it have to? And how do we even know, right? If you affect one person and they affect another person, how do we know how far it goes out?
Exactly. Exactly. You know? I mean, it's very hard to measure. So to put these arbitrary numbers on things of such a huge thing. Yeah. And then it also makes it that much more difficult to get out of our own way. If all of a sudden, if I was in the prison library, frustrated, like, you know, I couldn't imagine. And I said, boy, I really want this book to impact a million people. It would have been very hard to continue writing.
It's a lot of pressure.
It's a tremendous amount of pressure.
Like, wait a minute. How about if I help one? Let's get on the scoreboard.
Right, know? Exactly.
Wow. Now, your first book, what is the title of that?
Blank Canvas, How I Reinvented My Life After Prison.
Wow. Great title. What are some of the key points you share in that book?
It is, I'll tell you, it's written in the first person. It's memoir. It started
nice.
Off as purely self-help. And I had my first editor said, you shine at writing in the first person. And I only had one chapter that I wrote in the first person.
Three years of work.
And she said, take it or leave it, but I highly suggest you turn this entire thing into a memoir.
Yeah, so those are powerful.
I had so much fun writing it. And the second one's going to be very similar to that because it's just the style I enjoy writing. But some of the key takeaways would be that our past cannot define us without our consent.
Ooh, I love that.
And, you know, there are tidbits in there. I don't come out and say, practice gratitude. I don't come out and say, accept acceptance. I just carry the reader through my journey through those things. But acceptance as a takeaway is one of the major ones. That was one of my first steps after Sean's visit to rebuilding and reinventing my life, was accepting reality of the fact that I am in prison. I did blow up my life. I am financially ruined. I am getting divorced. You know, all of these things I was wishing were different. And it just all of a sudden hit me. I said, I'm asking for something to be anything. It can't be anything other than it is.
Yeah.
It's already written in the book of time for eternity. It's happened. I can't change it. And by sitting here trying to fight it, I feel like I'm making progress, but I'm not. I'm just spinning my wheels. So I have to accept it. And it really hurt like hell to do that. But it gave me a baseline, gave me a starting line. It wasn't the optimal starting line, but it gave me a place to start. And that's one of the key takeaways. Gratitude is another takeaway. Forgiveness is another takeaway. I had to forgive myself for ignoring my heart.
Yeah. And I love that. And I love the past cannot define us without our consent. When you talk about self-forgiveness, I think this is a tough one for many people. How'd you go about that?
That was such a journey for me. And I think this is very important to say, is that I believe forgiveness is a journey. And quite frankly, it's something that still bubbles up for me, that still comes through. And when I have to have the wherewithal to say, you know, it is a journey, and to continually forgive myself. But I will backtrack a little bit. I knew that I was consumed by shame, you know, to the point that I was planning on how to kill myself. And I knew that shame would rule my life unless I did something about it. So then I started realizing, how do you counteract shame? How do you work through shame? And I hadn't yet really been introduced to Brené Brown and all of her wonderful work. A lot of this was just done through pure intuition and journaling. And I said, you know, shame lives and breathes in the dark. What do we
That's
do
right.
with something that lives and breathes in the dark? We shine a light on it. How do we shine a light on it? In my instance, I was paranoid of sharing my story with people. So I said, I've got to start sharing my story with people. Because if I own my story, I own my life. If my story owns me, it owns my life. So I said, I have to start sharing it. Sharing, public speaking, was my number one fear.
Oh, no. So that's awesome.
so it was, it's all interwoven.
Yeah.
And so I had to, you know, start battling my number one fear. I made the goal actually to deliver that TED talk when I was in prison, because I realized I made fear-based decisions. And I said, I've got to write down my fears and I've got to execute them. that's the life that I want to now live because I capitulated to fear. I now need to go headfirst into fear.
Yep.
And so I made that, and this all ties back to forgiveness, but I made that goal and I said, okay, so I've got to face my fears. I've got to share my story. Well, I don't necessarily trust myself to share my story. So I realized that I had no trust in myself because I had ignored the voice that told me not to do it. And by the way, it told me not to do it every single time I hit the send button. My fraud lasted for just under a year and probably took thousands of mouse clicks and thousands of decisions, each of them made in the face of my heart saying, don't do this. So I destroyed any self-trust that I had.
Yeah.
And I realized if I need to forgive myself, I can say the words, I can do some of the practices, but if I don't trust myself, the words are falling flat. So
yeah.
I made the commitment to conquer my fear of public speaking. And I kept that commitment, which built my self-trust, which opened the door for me to be able to forgive myself.
Yeah. Because it's a great point. If we don't trust ourselves, our word is worth nothing.
I tried when I was in prison, and I tried when I was just released to say, I forgive myself. I forgive myself. I forgive myself. And I could feel it. I could feel it just landing hollow.
That's exactly the word I was thinking of.
It was just hollow. And I said, you know, I don't trust these words. And so it really was making and keeping commitments over and over again for every major thing, every little thing, making and keeping those commitments and giving myself a pat on the back when I did.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because I was listening to another podcast or I don't know, I was reading someplace, but someone said the importance of making commitments to they're the most important commitments to keep. Because if we don't keep those, our word is worth nothing to ourselves,
ourselves, to others. And it just, you know, I started by committing to going to a Toastmasters meeting, which scared the heck out of me.
Oh, yeah.
And I committed when I went into that door, if they allowed, I was going not as a member. I was only a guest. And I said, you know, I didn't know what a Toastmasters meeting looked like. I didn't know the format. But I said, if they allow guests to speak, I'm going to be the first to volunteer. And so walking through that door, that was commitment number one. And that felt good. And then they had come to the table topic section of a Toastmasters meeting, which is they ask a question and you have 2 minutes to answer. And said, do we have any volunteers? And I shot my hand up. I also looked at my hand and go, who the hell just did that?
Why is that up in the air?
Why is that up in the air? Who did that?
Yeah.
I go up to the lectern, pull out my card. They ask a question. I speak for 26 seconds, a whopping 26 seconds. And I sat back down in my chair and I realized I faced my biggest fear and I didn't die. And I kept my commitment to myself. And I said, wow, there is really something to this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that, you know, the keeping commitment to yourself. And I totally understand that. Why is my hand up in the air? But it's also when we face our biggest fear and we don't like the worst, that's the worst thing that we can imagine. We face our biggest fear and nothing, it's kind of anticlimactic, right? I mean, you spoke for 26 seconds. No one booed you or said, get out of here. You know? And it's like, well, why was I worried about?
Well, the author, Sherry Huber, who is absolutely brilliant, and I hope I get this quote correct, she says something along the lines of, fear of the unknown is only fear of our own imagination.
Yeah, that's right. And our imagination is a scary place.
Our imagination will just come up with everything under the sun to keep us where we are, to keep us stuck in our status quo, in our nice little comfort zone. You're going to be laughed at. You're going to be judged. They're going to boo you.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it may be. And you know what? Yes. All of those things that our imagination comes up with, they could happen.
But they could.
That's the key word. They could happen.
Yeah.
They may happen. What also may happen is that it could work out brilliantly.
Yeah. You know, but it's just the brain. The brain likes safety. It likes security. It's like a misguided friend. You know, because we have to push through that. You know what I mean? We do. That's where the best things happen.
I think what's so interesting is that our brains are wired for survival.
Yep.
And our hearts, in a sense, are wired for meaning and fulfillment and purpose. Mm-hmm. And those two things are at cross purposes to each other.
Yep. which is why tapping into the meaning and the purpose is so important, because that is what helps us push through.
Having that why, having that significant of a why to help one person, to, you know, whatever it may be, just have that why. And that's that fuel to keep coming through. And also to, you know, when you have, we spoke about overwhelm before, of, you know, the idea of helping 1 million people, breaking it down to one person, taking these massive things and breaking them down into the next smallest step. You know, the Great Wall of China was not, it didn't all of a sudden magically appear. It started with one stone.
Believe it or not, it started with one stone.
So what is that one stone for whatever it is our biggest fear may be?
Yeah.
You know, what might that be? It could be as simple as looking something up on Google.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, that could literally be the first step.
Finding a Toastmasters club.
Exactly. Finding the club. That was a step. Finding the club.
Yeah. I mean, that's powerful. And I know I want to get to this because I know this is one of your passions. It's never too late to hit the reset button.
That I think is so, so important.
I wanted to make sure we talked about it.
Because it's so easy to say, I'm X years old. I missed my shot. I'm too late. You know, I'm irrelevant because of my age. Whatever it may be, there are so many examples of people who have hit the reset button, who have reinvented themselves after the age of 40, into their 80s. There's even a woman who was in her 90s who started writing books. You know, it's never too late. And I think this also ties to what we were saying about that overwhelm and that fear. And what a lot of people oftentimes do, and I'm very guilty of this as well, is let's say we want to write a book. We all of a sudden fast forward all the way to the finished product, you know, and it's, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to publish. I don't know how to.
Oh, that's right.
We don't know. And it comes back down to those small steps. And to just say that it's never too late to start, and all I have to do is actually start, and I start by taking that smallest step. I don't need to know how to do X, Y, and Z right now. I just need to go from A to B.
That's right.
You know, and to really, you know, I'm 48 years old. I figure I'm on the back nine of my life.
at least close, maybe.
Well, it's funny. Well, I mean, really quickly, when I was in prison, I really struggled with being there for 2 years. And I went, you know, before Sean's visit, I was like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to survive this? And so I said, wait a second, how long is 2 years out of my entire life? And so I did a little guesswork, and I totally out of the blue came up with 84 as my life expectancy, based on some family history, my personal health, and just completely shooting in the dark. I just said 84. And that number's really stuck with me. So based on that, I'm on the 10th hole of my life, mathematically. I am on the 10th hole of my life. And I love that because I really think so much of our lives, so many of us, the first half of our life is following the shoulds and expectations of others. And the things that we've been told lead to a quote unquote good life. Mm-hmm. The life that I was living before I was arrested. Because anybody on the outside would look in and be like, oh my God, he's living the life, not knowing what's going on inside. And I think the second half of our life is that opportunity to let go of those shoulds and expectations, hit that reset button, and cultivate that sense of meaning in our lives that I think Viktor Frankl called it a will to meaning. And I think that we all have that. I think it's intrinsic to us. It's inherent to us. And I also think, I think purpose is very important. I think meaning is much more accessible.
Yeah. Okay. So I have to ask, what's the distinction between the two, meaning and purpose, for you?
For me, meaning, we can give meaning to every single thing that we do. Mm-hmm. It's just a choice. This right now has meaning to me because we just met. We're having an amazing conversation. We are sharing stuff that I hope is of value to people. And so that right now, I'm giving it meaning. My purpose is much more pointed, and that would be to help one person by leveraging my story. And that's where I think the difference is a purpose to me is very pointed. It's very specific. Where meaning, my girlfriend and I love walking on the beach after work, weather permitting, even in the winter. We love going. We were out there the other day. We bundled up. I love doing that. But we pick up trash along the way.
Nice.
And that on top of it's an opportunity for us to have really good conversations. We also pick up sea glass, you know, mm-hmm. it's just kind of a fun thing, but we pick up trash. That gives that meaning. Yeah. And that's what I think the delineation is, our choice to give whatever circumstance we're in meaning. And that can look like a million different things. And that's why I think it's so much more accessible than a purpose.
Yeah. I think it's more accessible. I totally agree. And I think that the way we sometimes get caught living our lives, we miss it. And like a simple example, when I take my dogs for a walk, I have two rescue dogs and they both needed a lot of special attention at first. My one dog was up here when we first began. You might have seen him on the chair behind me. I never, ever, ever talk on my phone. Never. I am there for the dogs. I'm there for me. I'm there for that connection. And if it's just something that we're crossing off our to-do list, I think that takes the meaning away. You know what I mean?
I love that. I absolutely love that. It is. So what comes up for me, you're very intentional.
Yes.
You're very intentional in your walk. This is connect. Your intention is to connect.
Yep.
And that's when we really start living very intentionally. We can have a to-do list, but it's why am I doing this? What is
why?
My intention behind doing this? It gives it just a little bit extra layer. And even if it's something mundane on our to-do list, we're a little more invested and we give that little bit more of meaning. We take ourselves off that autopilot.
Yeah. And it's not, it can just bring more, I think, joy to things, you know? I mean, doing the dishes is not fun, although I actually do find it very therapeutic, whatever. But I also think, why are you doing it? Why are you doing the cleaning the house? Because I like to have a nice environment that's nice for my husband, for me, for the dogs. I enjoy that, you know? So it's just a little shift. And I think shifting to the intention, it really helps.
It absolutely does. Something that I do, and I'll be very honest, I'm much better about it in the morning with this practice that I'm about to say. And then as the day fades, you know, goes and fades. But before I do things, why am I doing this? And it can be, why am I meditating? Why am I practicing yoga this morning? Which are, those are things I do every single morning. But I ask myself every single morning, why am I doing this? And for me, that's my way of saying, what is my intention? And it changes every day.
Yeah.
Some days it's the same. Some days it's completely different. I try to listen to my heart and really then honor that when I'm going through whatever practice. I do it oftentimes when I'm stirring my coffee. Why am I stirring my coffee? So that I can make a delicious frothy drink that I enjoy while I'm writing. You know what I mean?
It just
adds a layer. And like I said, honestly, kind of the willpower, whatever it may be, it fades throughout the day. And it's something that I'm trying to carry through from the morning into the afternoon.
Yeah, I love that though, because it does connect you to why is it important? What's my intention? You know, I don't want to live my life just crossing off things at my to-do list. As much as I love having I love a to-do list. And my husband always jokes about me, because if I vacuum the floor and it's not on the to-do list, I will go and I will write it on the list so I can cross it off. That's insane.
You like all of us, are a little bit of a dopamine junkie. Because when we cross it off, we get our little shot of dopamine.
It feels so good to cross things off that list.
It's brilliant. I do the same thing, by the way.
Yeah.
I do the same exact thing.
Yeah. And you know what? It's not bad. It's a great way to get started in the morning, have those things that you can cross off quickly. It's that, you know, the dopamine, the motivation going. So wanted to ask you too, before we run out of time, what is your second book going to be about?
Oh God. You know, I wish I need to be able to articulate this better. My writing process is like the most daunting, ridiculous thing in the world. I thought I would have learned from the first book. It took me 6 years, God knows how many drafts. I wrote approximately 1 million words to get to the 52,000 that are in my book. And I'm realizing on the second book, that's just part of my process. And my motivation for the second book is I want to learn. If I'm not learning along the way, how can I expect the reader to learn as well? So I'm exploring areas that I know that I coach on, but I'm exploring them much deeper than I ever have. And it really is our will to meaning and how we are conditioned to follow pleasure and power under the guise that it's going to bring us meaning. And it isn't until we reach that inflection point where we kind of started our conversation of talking about the treadmill and the three options. It's really that choice to get off the treadmill and to take the path of meaning, to take the unknown, because there's no amount of externals that are ever going to fill us from the inside. And no. So I really want to explore our intrinsic desire for meaning, how we are conditioned to take the incorrect paths, and how to get on the correct path.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great thing to explore.
I'm having a wonderful time doing it. I say that, but at the same time, when I really start thinking, when I'm writing, I'm like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. My posture is terrible. My face is contorted. My brain is thinking. I was like, where do I want to go? And one of the frustrations of a writer is I know the words are out there. I can feel them. I can sense them. And I can't quite grab them, not yet. And I think that's why I wrote a million to get to the 52 that are in there. But it's just part of the process. But it's that's how I learn.
Yeah. You know, have you ever heard, there's a quote by, I think it's Margaret Atwood. And she said, the page waits pretending to be blank.
Yeah,
and I'm like, that's perfect.
She's got so many brilliant quotes when it comes to writing, and she's obviously an amazing writer, but yes, she's got,
oh my God, that's a great one though. I think about that all the time. Like it's there. Just have to keep working on it, you know?
This to me ties back to what we were talking about. That self-trust is really just sitting down and knowing that there's something there.
Yeah, there is.
You know, there always is. And when I'm stuck, I follow Hemingway's advice, write one true sentence, followed by another true sentence, followed by another true sentence. They don't have to be good. They just have to be true. And every single time I've done that, it's worked. All of a sudden, the ball gets rolling.
Yeah. I love that. I'm going to remember that. I'll be writing that down.
It's a good one.
Came in front of me. Yeah. So this has been great. Tell us a little bit about the work you do and how people can learn more or reach out to you, that type of thing.
So yeah, I'm a reinvention architect and mindset coach. Because nobody knows what the heck a reinvention architect is.
But I love that title.
I was thrilled when I really started thinking about what do I want to call myself? And I said, what do I know better than anything else? I know how to reinvent a life. I know how to connect with meaning. And I know that I rebuilt my life. And that's how I landed upon reinvention architect. So I worked one-on-one with my clients to connect with that intrinsic desire for meaning. And we go on the journey of taking aligned, intentional, consistent action to connect to that meaning and to their calling. And that is the work I do. I absolutely love it. It brings me so much joy and circles back to that helping one person. I get to do that one at a time. And, you know, I just get so much fulfillment from it. And that is, that's one of the things I do, writing. And then I'm also a keynote speaker. Mm-hmm. So I've been now that things are opening up, you know, just delivering keynotes, which is so much fun to know that was my one time biggest fear. And now, you know, I get to go on stage. I've got, you know, a couple coming up soon, audiences of 500 plus, and I'm thrilled by that.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely thrilled by that.
Yeah. So for people out there listening, because what public speaking, number one fear, are you still, do you still feel that like in the pit of your stomach before you step out?
Absolutely. Yep. I don't think that ever goes away. Mm-hmm. And it is a question of reframing it to excitement. It's really no different than volunteering to get on a roller coaster.
Yeah. I'd rather give the speech.
Yeah. Nobody's forcing me to be up there. You know, I'm consciously choosing to do this. And that's fright that I feel is actually really just excitement. And I know what's waiting for me every single time I get off stage. It's just magic every single time.
Yeah. And as soon as you step out there, at least for me, fear goes away. And I love it. Like that's my zone. But yeah, you still get that, ooh, like butterflies. That just means you're about to do something important.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So Craig, how can people find you? What's the best way for them to reach out or to follow you? Because I know you're very prolific on LinkedIn.
So LinkedIn, we'll start with there. It's Craig Stanlon on LinkedIn. My website is craigstanlon.com. I'm also on Instagram, Craig_Stanlon. And my TED Talk is How I Learned My Greatest Worth in Federal Prison. And my book, Blank Canvas, How I Reinvented My Life After Prison.
Perfect. And we'll put all the links in the show notes so it's easy for people to find. This has just been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on, for sharing and, you know, and inspiring others with your story.
Bobby, thank you so much for having me on. And I'll take a real quick second to acknowledge you for having this platform so that people come on and share their stories. Because I think we're all unique and our stories are unique, but the emotions behind those stories is where we connect as human beings. And so for you to have this platform allows us to do that. So thank you very much.
Thank you for saying that. It's why I started it in the first place.
Oh, awesome.
I love diving into other people's stories because there's always so much to harvest. Here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, the past cannot define us without our consent. I absolutely love that. Back in the day, I was a huge Criminal Minds fan, huge. And there was an episode when Rossi said, scars remind us of where we have been. They don't have to determine where we go. Insight number two. I love when Craig was talking about owning his story instead of it owning him. We don't have to be owned by our stories. We can write our own stories, a new chapter. And number three, it is never too late to hit the reset button. Never. One of the things that I've heard people say when they're thinking about starting a new venture is, you know, something along the lines of, it's going to take a long time. And it might. I was at a conference once, way back in 2002, I think it was. And someone was there, a speaker, and he was talking about this. And he said, you know, the thing is, you're going to be 10 years older either way. Where do you want to be in 10 years? As always, I had to really work to keep those to three. It's not easy to do as I have a page full of notes. As always, I just want to thank you so much for listening, for tuning in, and for sharing this podcast with others. I am incredibly grateful for that. If you loved today's episode, if you could do me a quick favor and leave us a review on Apple, that helps more people find us, and I would just be immensely grateful. Until next time, I hope that you have an amazing week and that you thrive no matter what.